Welcome back, State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy to the program for another Beacon Hill update. Hey, Tacky, good to see you.
Good to see you, Joe. Happy for another chat during the week.
Absolutely. This is great to get an update from you, from your, is that your dining room or your kitchen or your family room?
In the dining room. I'm not going to show you the rest of the table because I've kind of commandeered this as my new office, which is unfortunate for the family, but as we know, I'm hunkered in with me and my mom, so the two of us. So we've not had to use this dining room for any family gatherings at all this year. So now it's become my extended workspace for now until the pandemic ends. And there'll be quite a bit of time for me to clean this up once pandemic ends.
Yes, that'll be your job. I'm sure your mother will see to it as well.
Pretty much. I mean, I have a corner of non-perishables in the room over here. Now I got like my mom's soda and things like that. And crackers and chips and whatnot, the junk food pile, as part of our version of hoarding during the pandemic.
Well, speaking of the pandemic, as of this taping, Quincy is now flipped into the red zone on the risk assessment map, according to the state guidelines, unfortunately.
Yeah, Quincy, if you look at the statistics, was, you know, always in the high yellow, for the lack of a better term, for people don't know that it's kind of a broad range, like it's a 1 to 10 situation where your risk level is low, you're between 1 and 3, and you guys can figure out the rest on your own to like the top end of the red. So we just floated right into the red side of that. And if people look at the map online, they know that we're surrounded by red prior to going to red. So not necessarily shocking as a pass-through community in a community for the South Shore that a lot of business is done, whether we retail shopping or going to work. So it was bound to happen at some point. It was just remarkably good job by the residents to go this long before we did go red, to be honest with you. And 66 communities yesterday also made the red zone. So it's not just us. So, you know, this talk about this Thanksgiving surge within a surge, it did appear in Massachusetts. You know, Christmas is coming and New Year's is coming. New Year scares me more than Christmas, to be honest with you, because of the how we celebrate New Year's and our approach to it. So don't be surprised, you know, sometime between January 10th and January 20th, you see another massive spike for a surge and a surge inside of a surge, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. It's a reason that these field hospitals are back up and running again, right?
Yeah, Worcester's been up and running. It actually has made national news. ABC News have been covering the field hospital in Worcester. I still think that we are the most successful in terms of managing our healthcare system in the COVID situation. And as I talked about all summer, the healthcare industry is taking a lot of financial losses for maintaining COVID-ready facilities because you're not being compensated for maintaining COVID-ready facilities and reducing your non-essential medical procedures. Well, non-life-threatening today, more accurately. These medical procedures are necessary. But you're not going to die tomorrow morning if you don't do it, essentially. So, you know, non-immediate life-threatening medical procedures. So, you know, as a result, you know, I was a little curious on Tuesday about the Lowell facility opening up. Then I looked online in the Northeast Corridor. All their ICU beds have been consumed, all 100% consumption. And the statewide average is about 83% ICU beds are filled. So, I mean, I know it's hard to visualize because what the news focuses on, you know, very specific instances. I think the public has a hard time visualizing exactly the stress the healthcare systems under as a whole because it's hard to get your mind around. But when your hospital beds are 83% ICU capacity, we're talking about people in real trouble here. I mean, I'm not an ICU person. I'm sure you can get an ICU worker that knows a nurse, a doctor, administrator. I'm sure people on this call has friends that work in healthcare industry, and they should really talk to them about what's really going on in those kind of conversations. But, you know, it is the fact that we've gone to non-essential, immediate essential surgeries means they're going to have to start converting back the regular hospital beds into ICU and then triage the non-life-threatening cases to the field hospitals. So the fact one region has already gone 100% used up, which is the Northeast region on the New Hampshire border, as no more ICU beds, conventional ICU beds. You know, they're already moving into the over 100% capacity they've been keeping on standby all summer.
Well, the term ICU, intensive care unit, is just that. It's intensive care. So when that doctor, when that nurse, that technician is in the ICU, they're not sitting at their desk, you know, reading emails and checking the magazines. They are at that patient's side for every minute that they're on duty, providing life-saving care. Without them, that person would not continue to live.
Yeah, it's the highest level of service. And the greater Boston area, I believe, has 4,300 ICU beds. 83% of those have been used. Statewide, now you're making trying to think of numbers. I'm trying to remember the table in my head right now. But, you know, it's somewhere in the area of probably 9,000-ish ICU beds, and 83% are consumed. So I think, I have to look at it again. But the governor's objective was to make it 200% capacity ICU beds, which means the hospitals are currently ready to do massive conversion. So, you know, even 83% capacity of 4,300 beds, I mean, we're talking like 3,000 plus people, you know, 3,200 people or so in ICU now and growing in the greater Boston area. We've never seen that many beds used under normal means. And even in the Boston bombing, where there was a lot of triage, there was not a lot of people in ICU for the Boston bombing. I mean, a lot of consumption of hospital room for emergency care because lots and lots of people were hurt. But, I mean, I think there's this gravity here that people aren't seeing in the news easily, because it's hard to really just visualize, you know, the visualization of 5,000-7,000 people in an ICU unit, and the majority of them are probably on some kind of ventilator.
That's true. Yeah. It's, you know, they don't let the TV news cameras into the ICU unit. So it's like you say, you can't visualize it because you can't see it. And that's been kind of an overwhelming theme of this whole pandemic is, you know, it's unseen. So it's not real to a lot of people.
Well, until it hit home. I mean, I was talking to one friend about this, and one person was ranting about how this was in Rio during an outdoor social gathering, and the other person was an ICU nurse. And, the story I got was she went a little bombastic on the other family, saying that, you know, this isn't real while she's watching people die. And that's the thought. I think it's very disturbing on social media and other things that, you know, they're undervaluing other families. But also the emotional toll and physical toll has on our healthcare workers.
Yeah, and, you know, tolls that we don't even know yet, because we're still in the midst of it when it comes to children not socializing, people being separated from their families for extended periods of time. So this is still, the end hasn't been written yet.
No, and healthcare workers have to be enormously cautious among their own families. I mean, if you're working in any kind of healthcare setting where anywhere near a COVID family situation, it doesn't matter if you're an administrator or an ICU nurse or doctor, you have to be extremely cautious because you're in higher chance of contraction. The precautions that are needed to protect your family and keep away from loved ones that you can't be near. I mean, you know, you have to make these kind of hard choices. Someone's very fortunate, like myself. I mean, I'm very fortunate to be able to work from home or work remotely and care for my mom. But not everybody has a luxury, and I'm aware of that. I'm very aware of that. And, people have to be, you know, very cautious of how they go about this. And, I'm not telling people to advertise their lives to folks, but I think people need to be more sensitive about the complexity of everyone's situation.
What do you think about the governor's recent rollback to phase three, part one, I guess, if you will?
Well, it's a result of the Thanksgiving surge. Period. I mean, once again, I've repeated myself, the governor has, every public official has, and says that the only way we're going to get through this, not just on a healthcare level, but an economic level, is everyone behaves properly. It doesn't matter if you're 10 years old or you're 80 years old. It's incumbent on all of us to behave properly regarding this. Taking it very serious as a healthcare issue that you may be an asymptomatic carrier. Just because, the test results are a little bit deceptive in the sense that it's only people that actually got a test. It doesn't really account for people who never got a test and not showing actual symptoms or very mild symptoms that are carriers. So, I mean, the test results is only a tip of an iceberg on a global level about the realistic infection rates. So, you know, I think that's the thing that people really need to understand. If we did test all 6.6 million people in the state of Massachusetts, you know, in one day, simultaneously, we would have a good grasp of the infection rate. But that isn't how this works.
Right. Exactly.
We do not have that. And, you know, healthcare workers are required to be tested more than once. You know, patients coming out of this stuff are tested more than once, which is part of the state's calculation. So, I mean, you know, some of these folks are required to because of the nature of their occupation. I think this is kind of part of the data explanation. I don't think it's done a great job publicly that your neighbor could be infected, but never been tested.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's quite possible. There is a glimmer of hope, though, right, with the vaccines now that are coming, although, you know, it's going to be a while before they have any serious impact, I guess.
Yeah, the FDA approved for emergency use the Pfizer vaccine, I believe yesterday. I'm trying to remember my news. Everything blurs. And Moderna is up next, which we all pretty much know it's going to be emergency use authorized. I don't think anybody has any doubt in their mind about that. It is a two-dose vaccine. So when you see how many doses are in use, cut that by half how people are getting. So the state is expected to get just under 100,000 doses sometime in the month of December. Hopefully we're supposed to get about 49,000-ish, 40,000-ish, 40,000-ish doses by immediately this month. The governor has dictated who goes first for this vaccine. It is CDC guideline recommendations. Each state is responsible for the prioritization. So people in direct COVID contact, people who are at the highest risk in cognitive care are receiving the vaccine first. Once we get past the first group of folks, there's the phase two folks, which are folks that are in public health but not direct COVID care, people age 65, and certain medical conditions, people in public spaces that are working for essential workers, such as grocery stores, for example, will be on the phase two section, that combination. Those of us who are relatively healthy, who are not age 65 above and do not have other compromising immune system issues are in phase three. Depending on the speed of getting these doses, phase three may take a while. I'm not extremely optimistic that I will be receiving a dose anytime soon. However, my mom, given her age and her medical conditions, will likely get in sometime in phase two whenever that becomes available. And people ask why. Well, it was very simple. Your healthcare workers are on the front lines of COVID. They're the highest possibility of getting risk. The rest of us who are working to be very conscious on social distancing, mask wearing, hand washing, and all the other, quite frankly, very easy and simple and common sense issues that I do not think is an inconvenience for any of us, should be able to keep ourselves safe because we have a lower risk of contact. So people ask me about the state of opening up with the vaccine. I inform folks that the average age of employees are 35 and below. My staff has only one person who's age of 30. So the reality is they're at the bottom of the line on vaccine recipients. But there still can be carriers. And yes, they can still get ill. And yes, they can die. So, but because of their lower or more actually stronger immune system because of age, and unless they have an immune compromised medical condition that says otherwise, they don't expect the state house to open anytime soon until we are able to vaccinate our staff.
Right, and that's why, too, we'll be wearing masks for quite a while to come, too.
I fully expect we should continue this process of mask wearing and very high level hygiene to at least into 2022 because of the length of time it takes the vaccine to roll out. And also remind folks, it's a global issue. So the fact is that the first countries to come with the vaccine is the United States and the European countries, namely the UK, with AstraZeneca, which is actually operates in the US, even though they have a German partner. You know, the three big biotech companies have physical presence in the US. the issue I talked about in the past is also the supplemental medical supplies, whether it be the needles, the vials, the gloves, the swabs, you know, the alcohol pads, the safety disposal of those needles, because obviously once you use the needle and you to inject the vaccine, you could potentially have a COVID positive needle. So you have a lot of these other medical supplies that have to be rolled out. And of course, the human beings to inject you with. So, you know, CVS is getting ready to provide you that injection, same way to provide the flu shots. You enlist other medical professionals like dentists and others that have experience in needles to provide administration. So I don't know if there's going to be a scope of practice expansion as an emergency order by the governor if we get a large number of doses in a very short period of time.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see if some of the field hospitals are utilized for vaccinations, perhaps, if the National Guard is called in to assist with that, or, gosh, I don't know, the Red Cross, perhaps, or, you know, paramedics. There's, I'm sure, a list of folks that are capable.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of healthcare workers out there that I would actually prefer the healthcare workers first to provide a vaccine shot before a non-healthcare worker, personally speaking. That is my preference. And you're right, between the emergency medical personnel and other types of medical professionals out there, there is no shortage of people that we could do that and expand scope of practice, including medical students again. I mean, we could get medical students to serve any level of residency or any amount of time of residency to administer shots. And of course, now we actually have to keep track of our shots. It's an updated medical record, and these are going to require boosters within a 21-day period, 24 days, depending which one you're taking. And you have to be reminded to go back again. So you have to schedule people to come back twice in a short period of time. And this will be inconvenience for us in the sense that you have to make time out of your day to do this. So hopefully employers will understand the importance of this, and we do too, that do not put this off. It's not like the flu shot where people wait till like December to get it, right? And now to really remind people to get the vaccine the shingles vaccine shot as well, which is a relatively new one. But you know, if you're over a certain age, you have a higher chance of getting shingles. So, you know, there's a big part of it. And the polling shows that about 42% of the population still is going to take it. Is skeptical of taking it. They're not very strongly interested. But that being said, I mean, to achieve a start of a herd immunity opportunity, you need 60% participation. And to do proper immunity, in my opinion, you need to get closer to 90% at the end globally. So, you know, it's going to take a bit of time to try to, you know, get past 360 some odd million people in the United States. Hopefully the census number shows that, as well as, you know, the 7-ish billion people globally.
Yeah, this is, unprecedented for sure. No question.
And certain regions are very difficult to get the vaccine to because of the refrigeration component. A lot of developing countries do not have refrigeration in minus 94. And an example of things like that, the polio and measles have not been exterminated despite having a vaccine for those for decades because of trying to reach a certain populations that do travel around. It's just that the medical care does not have the facilities to store and administer these vaccines.
Yeah.
So in a big global picture level, you know, you're like, oh, there are isolated places to never get here. Like, no, this COVID actually got pretty quickly around the planet. Including to some tribes in South America that are pretty much isolated from general civilization. They got COVID too. It was very early on. There was a story about that. I was like, are you, what? Really? Yeah.
It's why they call it a pandemic, right?
It made it to the isolated islands in the Pacific.
Right. You know, how important is a federal stimulus package to Massachusetts and to Quincy, Tacky?
It's very important to everybody in the country, including the states. You know, the Democrats in the House continue to advocate for, and our Democrats in particular in our delegation in the Senate, you know, also been advocating for some kind of assistance for the state directly, as well as continuation of expansion of unemployment benefits and direct assistance to businesses. Unfortunately, we all know, we've experienced for the first round, we can't help every single person. But I mean, we're just trying to help the most people possible. And certain industries that weren't addressed may not still get addressed, like the hotel industry, for example. You've seen the layoffs finally come after they've been trying to hold out as long as possible with the hope of this turning around. And the restaurant industry continues to be devastated, as well as the tourist industries and businesses that are very dependent on people traveling to Massachusetts. So, it's still critically important to do that. And with the Biden administration coming in this January, he is going to be president January 20th. Doesn't matter where you swear the man in. Once he's sworn in, he's the president. And the House staying Democratic. Of course, the question is the U.S. Senate. And if it stays Republican, whether or not they'd be under sufficient pressure to look at any kind of $1 trillion package to get us through this cold winter on all of us, both on the health side and economically. So, we're hoping that something will happen. And this will help us out, not just COVID relief, but also help us stabilize a budget going to FY22. We're able to plug a massive hole through one-time funds in FY21. And the governor is going to be putting out a proposed budget in late January. We just finished a budget. We're finishing a budget and starting right away. So this is unprecedented. But any assistance the feds can give us gives us the ability to carry money over to FY22 to plug the gap, because we won't feel the full impact of COVID economic impact until we have a full year of the economic damage. And FY22 is when we're going to see it. So we shall see how those Georgia races pan out in the control of the U.S. Senate. We're about, 5 or so weeks away from a new administration.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about a local issue, the MBTA, and in particular, the bus maintenance facility they want to build in Quincy. Folks are asking me, why are they spending all this money when they're facing a $600 million budget shortfall?
Yeah, this is the complication. The T is that they're having a financial shortfall. We're having to maintain the system simultaneously. And the bus proposal for the garage is actually in Ron's district, so it's not in mine, but obviously it does impact all of us, because that's where the buses come out to serve all our constituency and our surrounding communities. And this is a project that I had a public meeting last January. There was a virtual public meeting in the fall, and there's going to be another public meeting next week to inform people where they are in the process. They're about 20%-ish design phase where they are right now. And this is not a project that's not going to be done to at least 2024 at the earliest. So it's bond money, it's capital money they have to borrow to do this project. So it's not really part of the operational cost money. The MBTA's biggest challenge right now through a whole pandemic is the fact that ridership has been reduced to about 30% of its original levels. Fares pay only about 30% of their budget. So contrary to popular belief, riders only pay 30 cents of a 10 or 3 cents on a dollar towards the T's functionalities. The biggest chunk, which is more than half, is the state sales tax. So they get 1 cent of 6.25%, so 1 penny goes to the T before I even touch the budget. It's already pre-allocated. So that's the tune generally of $1 billion. But given pandemic, again, the impact on retail sales actually has a direct impact on the MBTA's budget. So that's one. And then secondly, of course, is the ridership. So when you're down to 30% below, less than 30% of what you were normally, that's a monstrous budget impact. Until a vaccine comes forward and we return some level of normality, that the T will be facing a budget crisis from lack of ridership for some time. And even then, the change in our workplace, using virtual workplace probably more often, will have an impact on T ridership for suburban communities going into Boston. So you may see sometime probably by 2023, new plans on how public transportation is going to work, as well as commercial office space in Boston in particular. Around by 2023 on how we're going to restructure our economy based on this new type of work environment we're in right now, which I truly believe a good portion of our economy, this is permanent. Obviously, I'm not. I'm a people thing. But even for me, I'm thinking about, as a committee chair, running more committee educational sessions via a virtual, as opposed to trying to hold a session, educational session for membership inside the state house. I don't have to educate 10 members, which is manageable over this medium, as opposed to trying to get them all in from all parts of the state to come to an educational meeting. And I got a certain coffee and donuts and other refreshments. So I saved some money on that, but you can refresh yourself at home. But I mean, I will have to go to the office. I will go to public meetings. I will go to events, obviously, once we're through all this. But, certain other aspects, like I just described, maybe more convenient for my colleagues in Amherst and parts out west and parts of the Cape and parts of the north, doing like an educational opportunity through this format. So, yes, I do think that there's going to be substantial changes in our economy and how we do business. And that will have an impact on the T. That will still have an impact on downtown businesses. They'll have an impact on a lot of different aspects of services that are provided to those, provided by and supported by, employees that go into Boston and Quincy and other places from suburban communities.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's going to be a ripple effect for decades to come in kind of the whole paradigm of the way things have been done up until this point. And probably generations after us will wonder why we ever did it any other way.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think young people in particular who are FaceTiming on a regular basis knows how to utilize a number of different mediums, from TikTok to Instagram to Facebook messaging. And I know there's all kinds of other apps out there. I have no idea what they are, unless they're under the age of 20. They're already very much engaged in. And, I don't want to sound older than I am, but, I got like 5 different apps on my phone now. I don't know what they do. I don't do video conferencing, but there's that learning curve that I'm just kind of like, well, how do we do this? And I'm pushing buttons, and it's not the same interface, the interface I used before. So I have to learn the whole new user interface on a different app. And I know it's not that complicated, but when you're used to seeing a button on one side of the screen, it's moved to the other side of the screen. You're like, why is it not the side? I know it sounds silly, but I'm up to 5 different video working apps on my devices. And I anticipate there might be more coming, given the fact that every industry I talk to, every government organization, not just state government I talk to, all use different mediums.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's, the free market enterprise showing itself there. Everybody can develop what they want.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, like when I do one of the Mass High Tech Council, they use Uber Conference. It's the only thing I use that for, because they're the ones who do it in those meetings. So whether it be an educational seminar or a full-blown legislative meeting, that's the medium. So they're a host, that's what they're going to use. So what am I going to say?
Let's talk about, you mentioned New Year's, Tacky. What is the Lunar New Year going to look like here in Quincy?
It's going to be another virtual one. Quincy Asian Resources will hold a virtual Lunar Festival. I've mentioned more than once already about the importance of us supporting our local organizations. If people have any ability to make any kind of donations to any local organization, I would ask that you, if you're able to, definitely please do. Even just dropping food at the Stop and Shop food box for the food pantries. And every little bit helps. And Quincy Asian Resources is also not immune to this pandemic and its services, while a lot of it's going virtual. So, they're going to be putting together the other one with QATV at some point, another recording for them to try to put together some kind of virtual event. It's very difficult to do performances because of the social distancing guidelines. And a lot of schools are, and the parents are also very hesitant about, close contact. So things like the lion dance being done in Massachusetts is not going to happen, because you're literally right on top of each other. Same thing with a lot of kung fu demonstrations, martial art demonstrations. So they're trying to figure out how to provide some entertainment available, because the different industries need to be provided safely. So that, I know that conversation's in the works, because I also had a conversation about some ideas that we could do, but it would be enormously challenging, very challenging.
Yeah, but it will happen nonetheless, virtually or not. There will be some indication that there is a new year.
It will be, because it's going to be the year of the ox. So it's my turn on the cycle. So next year is the year of ox. So I'm an ox. My turn.
Well, let's hope that that bodes well for 2021.
Well, you can hope because we're getting out of the year of the rat. So the zodiac did not predict pandemic. Generally, start of a cycle is generally a fairly prosperous start, but obviously not this time around.
Right. Let's give out some ways folks can get a hold of you.
Sure. The telephone continues to work very well. It's 617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. Again, if you're not sure what button to push, push any button. You get to a voicemail of a staffer, the staff will get to us. It turns out our voicemails are now emailed to staff. So we will get them. Checking voicemail has now also changed in the world. Whoever thought that you can email your voicemail to us. So, you know, we are getting timely at all times of day. You always can email me at tacky@mahouse.gov. tacky@mahouse.gov. I will get your emails. Emails have slowed down as we close into the holiday season, other than holiday reading emails. So it'll be a little quicker on finding your email now. Obviously, you can reach me at tackychan.org, tackychan.org, which is really kind of an informational page we try to update as much as possible on the user information as well as COVID information. And Tacky Chan, State Representative, State Representative Tacky Chan on Facebook is a public website. It's not a, you do not have to be a Facebook user. And we are trying to regularly post as much COVID information up there. And now we're posting up holiday scam information. Again, this is that time of year people try to prey on folks insecurities by falsifying who they are to get money out of you, or buying gift cards, actually. So, you know, we're putting up a lot of consumer information lately as well.
All right. Good stuff, Tacky. Thanks so much. Great to see you again.
Good to see you. And I'll talk to you again in another week.
Sounds like a plan. All right. Stay safe. Be well.
Stay safe and be well.